This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. It's our Health and Living segment. Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon in the studio with us. Today's topic is, musculoskeletal growth, adaptation and decline. Well, we're just off the SEA Games. We had a holiday. We're very fortunate that Monday was a holiday. Our sportsmen and sportswomen did so well. But nobody will deny the amount of hard work and training that's gone into preparation for the SEA Games. Very much at a cost for many of the athletes and sportsmen and sportswomen. So we're going to find out how the musculoskeletal system adapts to sports like these when they do it on such an elite level and, it's almost a daily thing for hours on end. What is that actually doing to our body? And that's why Dr. Rajesh is here. Welcome to the show. How are you today?
Thanks very much. We're very good. Lovely to be in the studio, especially on a cold, rainy day like this.
On the first day of work, when everyone is like half, neither here nor there. I mean, the 5 days was a good break.
It was a lovely break.
Wasn't it too long, though?
No such thing. Coffee. The solution is in coffee.
Okay, all right.
You drink enough coffee, all your problems will go away.
Of course, always. So let's talk about the musculoskeletal system. Can it actually adapt? I mean, for people who are constantly putting some kind of stress on certain parts of the system.
Look, I think the adaptability of the musculoskeletal system is grossly underrated. So let's take something, for example, your kidney. Right, so let's take a kidney as a different system. Now, you can't expand the function of your kidney. The function of your kidney is the function of your kidney. You drink too much water, you're going to get an excess load of water and complications thereof. You can't train your kidney to become better. You can train your brain up to a certain point in terms of making a part of your brain function better, but you can't double the size of your brain, you can't double the size of your kidney, you can double the size of your skeletal system.
So, what about your heart?
Okay, so the heart's a very special instance of the skeletal system. As Nick Cave said, the heart is a muscle and it pumps blood. That's true. And the heart will respond to stresses in the same way that the rest of the musculoskeletal system will respond to stresses. There's a big but, though. In the dynamic of the heart, if the heart, let's say you have a normal size heart, and then you make that heart pump against high pressure. So it's just like you taking a piece of weight and lifting it to curl your biceps. What happens with the biceps when you push it against resistance? Mm-hmm. The biceps gets bigger. What happens to the wall of the heart when it pushes against resistance? The wall gets thicker. The problem is, though, when the wall gets thicker, it becomes stiff. And when it becomes stiff, blood can't flow into the heart to be pumped out. Then you get heart failure. So that idea of adaptation gone wrong is very underappreciated in the skeletal system. The skeletal system, as I've said, is immensely adaptable. So you can take somebody who's, 90 kilos. He can start training with weights. He can double his weight to 180 kilos. So that increase in weight didn't come from fat, it didn't come from internal organs, it came from skeletal tissue, which would be increase in bone density, increase in muscle mass. So people can get horrifically big musculoskeletal wise. So this idea of, firstly, one is adaptation, the other one is called metaplasia. Now, metaplasia is a medical concept that says one tissue can become another tissue. So within the skeletal system, all the tissues are plastic. So fat can become bone, can become cartilage, can become a blood vessel, can come back to bone, can become fibrous tissue, can become tendon, can become ligament. So that idea of plasticity within the skeletal system is very important when you think about adaptation and maladaptation. So this idea came to me when I saw three generations of the same family in my room at the same time. So there's a mum, grandson, and daughter. So I'm seeing the middle-aged lady for foot pain. And I examine her and I say, well, look, you've got this flat foot. It's pretty dynamic. That means that it's correctable. And these are the things that you have to do. So these are the maladaptations that have occurred in your skeletal system as a result of this dynamic flat foot. So I'm going to correct some of the maladaptations, and then you need to go off to the physiotherapist to correctly apply adaptations. So then she says, oh, okay, that's funny, because my son and my mom also have it. Can you have a look at them? So then I have a look at the son, and the son's probably about 5 or 6, and he's got the exact same thing that mother has. The point is, though, we've now picked it up at a point where I can say to her, okay, these are the things that you need to do to avoid the complications that you have. That's relatively straightforward. Mm-hmm. Now then mom comes and sits down. So, you know, mom's probably in her late 60s, early 70s. I have a look at the foot and I say, auntie, cannot, this one quite out already. The maladaptation and damage have gone on for so long that it's not recoverable and not reversible. So that was the idea behind this show, really, to give the idea that the skeletal system's very adaptable and very plastic. You can make it do lots of things. You don't appreciate what it is that you can make it do. And in the context where maybe you're not built like everybody else, then there's stuff that you can do to change what is it that your skeletal system is doing. Now, there's a lot of physiotherapy involved in this, and you know, I use the term physiotherapy very carefully. Physiotherapy doesn't mean going to, you know, a healthcare provider and going through a series of actions. That's not what physiotherapy is to me. Physiotherapy to me is a trainer directing you to correct a particular deficit that's been identified that is causing you a structural problem that needs to be corrected. So I work with lots and lots of different therapists, basically anybody who has that view that I share, I work with. And I work with a really diverse range of chiropractors, osteopaths, physiotherapists, personal trainers, basically anybody who can understand the concept and say, well, this is somebody who has a problem. I can't really work out what the problem is. Can you help me work out what the problem is and tell me what needs to be done? And that model works really well. So this idea of the plasticity in the skeletal system is really to say to people, you can change a lot of things. Not necessarily with intervention. Sometimes if healing has gone wrong, then you need an intervention. If the healing hasn't gone wrong, then you just need to correct that particular action, activity, muscle strength, bone posture, all of those things to prevent future complications.
When you talk about adaptation, you said it's highly adaptable, the skeletal system. But how would we know as individuals to what extent before this maladaptation actually starts to occur?
Okay, so pain is probably a useful first guide, right? So people will say, at the end of the day, that part really aches or that part really hurts or I really feel fatigued in that part. That's probably a good start that there's an overload. One of the concepts which I introduced much, much earlier in one of our earlier shows and I use regularly now is this idea of the functional unit. So a functional unit means a nerve that comes to supply a group of muscle fibers which create an action in a tendon across a joint. That's called a basic unit or a functional unit. In that functional unit, it can fail in a lot of places. Lots of people have nerve entrapments with secondary failure. And that's sort of this interesting concept that I've recently come to explore, the fact that the nerve entrapment is the primary problem. So the nerve entrapment causes the failure of sort of that functional unit. So let's start from the top. You've got the nerve. The muscle itself, okay, the muscle fails really with age. That's almost universal. Particularly in women who are postmenopausal. So postmenopausal women will say, Doc, I was fine. This year, I've just fallen apart. I don't know why it is.
Does that happen very quickly or just gradually?
About 2 years. So okay. within 2 years of the perimenopause, that's when things really start to fall apart. And the funny thing is, it's not with all women though. Some women say, well, I don't know, just nothing, you know, period stop, nothing happened. Other women say, everything cannot. You know, I can't get up in the morning, it's stiff, it aches. I can't walk around the house, it's uncomfortable. I can't wear my high heel shoes, it aches. You know, my shoulders ache, my back aches, everything just hurts. And those are very strong perimenopausal symptoms, and those come with menopause in women and in andropause with men. Men are not sort of excluded from it.
Yes. Thank you for saying that. Can you say that again?
It also comes with andropause. Yes. Men are not excluded
from it.
Which
is male menopause.
Well, it's kind of male menopause without the hysterical hormones to go with it.
How sure are you?
I don't know. I haven't got there yet.
It happens gradually, you know. Testosterone levels dropping very gradually as you age.
Look, it's a big topic, right?
It's
a big topic.
We'll come to it another day.
We will, because it's so huge. It's got so many facets, including the social facet. So whenever you talk about estrogen and testosterone, you start getting into that sort of George Lee conversations.
It's always George Lee.
It's always George
Lee. Testosterone equals George.
Okay. Right. Now let's go back. Back to what I was saying. Once you start talking about testosterone and estrogen and social function, the lines become very blurred. I'm a man of very limited knowledge. I like my problems to be very crisp, have to have very crisp borders and very defined. So I love measuring things. I like putting down my ultrasound probe and saying, this is the size of this muscle in cross-section. Let's compare it to the other side, which is not painful or which is normal or functioning normally. And people are always amazed going, wow, I didn't know that was such a big difference. Because the machine doesn't lie. You can actually measure out which particular muscle is affected. So we get to this idea of the functional unit, which is the nerve and then the muscle. So the muscle will fail with age. That's almost universal. It'll fail with menopause and andropause. It'll fail outside of that with failed recovery. So I've got some athletes who push their bodies too hard, and as a result of pushing their bodies too hard, they have chronic muscle tears, and those muscle tears have not healed. And the harder they work, the tear just goes on. And that's that sort of failed healing idea. The fact that that area of muscle has said, oh, you know, this is kind of too hard being muscle. I think I'll just become scar. Scar life is easy. Just, you know, take a ticket, swap over, and it becomes scar. Mm-hmm. So then you have failure of that functional unit because the muscle doesn't work.
Because it's scarred.
Because it's scarred, or sometimes because there's for want of a better technical word, mush tissue. So mm-hmm. when we operate on it, it's just mushy tissue. It's like wet tissue paper, where the healing response is inadequate. So there are micro blood vessels that form. Those micro blood vessels don't end up carrying on the journey to become healthy adult blood vessels. So they end up as diseased blind-ended tubes. And we know when we put those under the microscope, the blood vessels secrete a substance called substance P, which causes pain. So that's where the term substance P came from.
So during surgery, you just remove it?
Yeah, we basically just wipe it away like, you know, you would wipe away snot with the tissue. Really, okay. Just the medical term is called debridement or debridement, where we remove the tissue. We can do it open, so you can actually make a cut and do it, or you can do it closed, you can guide a device in, you can cook the tissue with heat, you can freeze the tissue with cold, or you can just damage the tissue mechanically just using a device just to create a controlled injury.
Will that restore function of that area?
Yeah, that'll start the healing response, and then the after is really important. So for people who are going to have this treatment, they need to understand what the aftercare is, because that's critical. If they stress the area again without allowing it to heal, it's just back to square one. But if you make a controlled injury and allow that area to heal as a result of the controlled injury, then you will get basically recovery of that area.
So just coming back to the SEA Games athlete, are you able to learn much about this person just by looking at them, the musculoskeletal system and know immediately what the problem is?
Roughly, I mean, certain athletes have certain predilections. So all our gymnasts have bung shoulders. That's sort of a given with gymnastics because that's what the sports predisposes to. All the hurdlers have torn hamstrings just because that's what hurdlers do. So the hockey players have bung fingers and wrists. That's just the sort of injuries that they have. So I think there's some sort of stereotypical injuries which occur in athletes. The question about how much can you tell from an athlete just by looking at them?
Okay.
I think the answer is probably pretty much how much you can tell by looking at a horse. You know, so if you look at horses, race horses look a certain way because they're built for racing. Mm-hmm. Work horses look a certain way because, you know, they're built for carrying loads. So I think the thing which amazes me more about the athletes which I treat is not so much how they look, but their functional adaptations. So I've had female gymnasts who are probably, I don't know, 40, 50 kilos, whose grip I can't break. They could crush my hand in a grip. But if you look at them, you go, well, okay, the muscle size is not so big. Where is that power coming from? That power is coming from adaptation. So that muscle fiber, which used to be used for power grip, or has now increased in size and number. So the nature of the material has changed.
And are you talking about something similar to the gym, as in when women work out, they always say go with repetitions rather than the weight, heavy weight?
No,
as
I mean, women do that because they don't want to get bulky. Yes. They want to get lean.
But
no,
you do get stronger.
You do get stronger, yes. And you do get stronger without getting bigger. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. So that's the same idea. So there's this idea of muscle fiber being of different character. There's fast twitch, slow twitch, and sort of an intermediate twitch. And each character can produce different amounts of power. The reason why the body doesn't just go and make all the muscle, as in to be like super duper strong muscle, is because there's a energy cost to muscle. So strong muscle requires a lot of energy expenditure to maintain. Weaker quality muscle requires less energy expenditure to maintain. So just, that's why athletes can eat and eat and eat.
Hence the protein as well.
The protein as well. The protein's necessary to build. You know, you can't build a house without bricks, mortar, and, you know, steel bars. So you cannot build muscle without protein.
Okay. We're discussing your muscles, bones in response to physical activity. We just finished the SEA Games. We're talking about how, you know, these muscles adapt for someone who takes part in such elite sports. If you have a question for us, give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-000, tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's Health and Living. Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon, in the studio with us. We are discussing your muscles and your bones and the ability of all of this to adapt to physical activity, whether or not it is, whether or not it's very intense or not, you know. I mean, so if I want to excel in sports, Dr. Rajesh, would you recommend that I choose one based on my musculoskeletal features or,
Without a doubt. Short people playing basketball, yeah, that's possible, but it's just so much harder. So there's some things which are very classic. Say, for example, the shape of the calf muscles. So there are two muscles.
So we all have to come and see you now before we actually embark on a career in sports?
There's already very good sports coaches available. This is public domain knowledge in high-level athletics. So there are lots of trainers, lots of sports coaches already know this information. The challenge is trying to make a balanced decision because, you know, there's a story about how they pick their swimmers in China. You know, they go to all the schools, they just line all the kids up from shortest to tallest, then they push them all in the swimming pool and see which one survives.
Yeah, okay. I'm not surprised.
So I don't know whether that's entirely true or not, but just because you have the physical characteristic for it doesn't mean that it's the ideal spot for you. So to answer your question, though, if you had a penchant for something, you know, I think sport is about the heart, not the body. If you had a penchant for something that your heart said, this is what I want to do, then it would be useful to exclude some of probably the common issues related to your body type in relation to that sport. So say, for example, I'm looking after some of some shuttlers now who have a very mild scoliosis. So scoliosis is where the back bone's not completely straight. And what position they play from and their dominant serve actually makes a difference to whether they have back pain or not. So that's something very simple I can advise. I can just point it out and say to coach, hey coach, look at this. Probably something you want to consider. You know, you may want to keep him facing more left all the time or more right all the time, or with the doubles, where do you want to position him in the court? So that's something that coach can easily do. The other one is in relation to the shape of the calf muscle. So this is very, very well studied. The bulk of the calf is made up of two muscles. The outer muscles called the gastrocnemius, the sort of people know them as the gastrocs. the inner muscle is called the soleus. Now, some people have a very short Achilles tendon, which means that the gastrocnemius muscle is very long and the soleus muscle is very short. Those people are adept at one particular kind of sport, which is more running. There's another one where the muscle and the tendon go right all the way to the heel, so they don't basically have any calves at all. They just have this sort of real trunk-like calves. Those people are more adept to power kind of situations, and if you put them where they're running, they may injure themselves. So the physical things are not trivial, but I don't think they're the make or break. I think the heart is the make or break.
Okay. Yong, you have a question.
Yes, good evening, Mira.
Good evening.
Just some sincere commendation for you. In fact, your show, together with Dr. George, is one I always look forward to. Okay.
Thank you, Yong.
Back to the couple of query. I had an accident years back, and because I'm not using the muscle, I suffer from muscle atrophy. That's one. The other thing is, you mentioned that we need protein to build up muscle. Are you talking about animal protein? Or for those vegetarians who don't take animal, what about plant protein?
Okay. Was there a question for the accident, Yong?
Yeah, about muscle atrophy.
Okay. What about muscle atrophy that you would like to know more about?
Well, I didn't use the muscle for a couple of months.
Okay.
And it shrink.
Sure. So how can you maybe bring it back?
Yeah.
Bring the strength back.
No, I resume using the muscle and it gone back to normal.
Okay, fantastic. Okay. Thank you, Yong. Bye-bye.
Okay, Yong, so to answer your question about protein, the challenge with proteins and vegetarianism is that there's class 1 proteins and class 2 proteins. So class 1 proteins basically mean that you have all the sort of very essential proteins together in one food. The class 2 proteins means that you don't have all the essential proteins available in one food. It doesn't mean you can't mix and match. So say, for example, for vegetarians, nuts are an excellent source of protein. You know, almonds, cashews, pistachios, walnuts, all of those things really very highly packed, not just in terms of amino acids, which are proteins, but also some of the very essential fats which are needed to build cells. So you need cholesterol to build cells. The wall of cells are made out of cholesterol. There's good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. So nuts, basically, if you're vegetarian, are your fail-safe food. The only thing about nuts is you need quite a lot. Imagine having to eat a cup full of almonds a day. You know, it's 250 grams of almonds a day. It's quarter a kilo. It's a lot of effort to chew through those amount of almonds a day.
Yeah, and it's not cheap.
That's true. So my recommendations for vegetarians who I treat who are needing to build muscle is egg white, right? So I say you can have 2 egg whites a day. You don't have to have them every day of the week. You can have them every second day. And you have them up to somewhere between 6 to 8 weeks. And that's a prescription medicine, as it were. So, you know, if you're a vegetarian, you take a medicine, regardless of what the source was, for a period of time, if it is needed for your health. So I say, well, this is basically the medicine that I'm giving you. It's just that it doesn't come in a tablet, it comes in an eggshell.
But some people don't eat eggs.
Yeah, they're toughies. They really are. And it's by the time they fail the sort of third or fourth time, they're usually willing to take some protein.
Because it's they need it.
Because they can feel it. It's not just that they need it. They can feel the effect of not having it and the damage and continued pain that it's causing them.
Okay. So, for an example, for those of us who go to the gym and then we lay off for 2 weeks, you can almost feel yourself getting all soft all over, you know. What's happening to adaptation here? I mean, does it only last a short period of time?
Yep. It's that you don't use it, you lose it.
Damn.
Yeah, I know. But that comes... That comes
all with, that hard work and then come Christmas and New Year.
Yes. It's got to do with genes and hormones. So when I worked in New Zealand, those Pacific and Maori Island guys, they were completely massive. And, you know, you'd say, do you go to the gym? And he goes, nah, bro, just chill out.
How did that feel?
It was nice to know they were gentle giants on my side. Because some of those guys were completely massive. But that was just that Polynesian gene that they had. And that was fine until they hit andropause. And then all that muscle just went to fat.
Mm-hmm. It's good to know it's just not the women.
It is not, no, just not the women. So the idea there is the interplay between genetics, environment, and I'd say hormones in particular. And I've got a little bit interested in the subject recently because some of the patients that I've been struggling with in terms of getting them over that deterioration hump, you know, they have a maladaptation, you know, maybe a shoulder, I fix that. Then a few months later, it's a knee, I fix that. Then half a year later, it's the other shoulder, and I fix that. And then I go, it's getting ridiculous. So for those people, I've actually started doing their hormone levels, and I'm surprised at how low some of those hormone levels are, sort of almost shockingly low. I'm going, oh my God, I can't believe I didn't pick this up before.
What sort of hormones?
Basically, the anabolic hormones. So we look at, I look specifically for this thing called homocysteine. So homocysteine is not so much a hormone, it's a byproduct of metabolism in the blood, and it actually affects the ability to repair. So homocysteinemia, meaning high homocysteine levels, is relatively common. It's an independent risk factor for heart disease. It's an independent risk factor for skeletal diseases, and it's treatable, right? Very, very simply. So the other thing we look for is
What do you do to treat it?
It's just you can give B supplementation, vitamin B supplementation. So usually it solves a problem. There are other therapies available as well. But, you know, usually by the time I diagnose this, I send it off. I say, look, you know, you need to see a clever doctor. I'm just a carpenter.
Okay. When people, okay, muscles have adapted, right? At what point or what are the symptoms, you know, or the alarm bells when you know it's doing more harm than good?
So nerve compressions. I see a fair few bodybuilders with nerve compressions. And the nerve travels between layers of muscles and through specialized tunnels in muscles. If the muscles get too big, they can start to impinge on the nerve. So some guys will come in and say, I've got buff, but this particular area is weak. I don't know why it's weak. And 9 times out of 10, it's a mechanical nerve compression from the fact that the nerve's being squished by the muscle around. And it's clear as day. You can see it on the ultrasound where the nerve goes. The nerve's really being throttled by the muscle, particularly when they make an activity. And you say, well, okay, so this is a problem.
And what do you do?
We release the nerve around the muscle. So we can use the ultrasound to guide a specialized instrument. We make the tunnel a little bit bigger, so we actually cut away some of the muscle fibers. Or we say to the patient, you know, stop training so much. The answer is inevitably, no, I'm not going to stop training. Mm-hmm. What can you do to help me train harder? And that works really well because it's a simple mechanical problem. Tunnel's too tight. You just make the tunnel bigger. Don't damage the nerve in the process of making the tunnel bigger, and problem solved.
Will it recur?
Rarely, though, because when we make the tunnel like 3 times bigger, 4 times bigger, with the expectation that, you know, it's going to squish down a little bit, and make sure that the nerve is very free. We follow it up, make sure that the compression of the nerve has resolved, and then just try and give some exercises to force the nerve to glide. Because if the nerve can glide, then it tends not to get entrapped.
We seem to be talking more about the muscles. What about the rest? The tendons, the bone?
Okay, so tendons are a little bit unique because they can't increase in number. So muscle is different from tendon and bone because when you make a muscle bigger, it increases in number. So the number of nuclei, the nucleus is sort of the heart and brains of a cell. One muscle can split into 2 nuclei, be it in the same muscle in 3 and 4. So you can actually get larger numbers of muscle fiber. With tendon and bone, you cannot. The number of cells is set. So the way it adapts is it changes the stuff that it produces. So a tendon cell will produce a very strong spiderweb kind of material. So it's probably a good analogy. If you imagine each tendon cell like a spider producing a single spider web, each tendon then produces more strands of spider web and better quality spider webs. So although the cell number is the same, the fibers of the tendon become very, very strong. Now with bone, it's a similar story. The number of cells are fixed. But what it produces is it produces this thing called matrix, which is, again, the analogy to the silk that a spider produces. it produces much, much, much more matrix. So the bone gets very, very dense and very strong. So hard is not the right word. Strong is actually the right word, because strong is a mixture of how much load the bone can take and how much you can bend the bone.
So diet does play a big role in adaptation?
No, diet plays a secondary role to adaptation. The principal role is in the stimulus.
Physical stress? Does it always have to be physical
stress? It has to be physical stress. It's actually, I mean, it's called Wolf's Law. So it's actually a law of remodeling, where when you stress a particular bone, for example, the structure of the bone will adapt to be able to carry that load. And the point at which that adaptation fails is when you get a stress fracture.
Okay. And all of this will start to slow down when you reduce the physical stress.
Yes.
Tendons become weaker. Those webs become
fewer in number and weaker.
Okay. And the muscle cells that have been, you know,
multiplied now, basically shrink down back to their basic number.
Okay.
People have...
Hence the power of exercise.
Hence the power of exercise. And people have a very, very fundamental shape. So it's interesting, because if you look at them just before their teenage years, you know, how they're built, that's the same shape they'll take when they're older.
Oh.
Because...
That's not too bad.
No, it's not too bad. But
provided you don't put on any weight.
Correct. It actually, if you look at really frail old people, and you look at photos of them when they were pre-pubescent, it's the same shape.
You're talking about prepubescent.
Prepubescent.
Okay.
Because what happens to the skeleton when you add hormones is what you and I see every day. You take away those hormones and what happens? All those changes regress.
Of course. Okay. When we come back, we're going to find out more about bone density. How does that affect our mortality or even longevity? If you have a question for Dr. Rajesh on adaptation of the musculoskeletal system, give us a call. The number is 0377109000. Tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 0187898899. Well, welcome back. It's Health and Living. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. Dr. Rajesh Singh in the studio with me, and we're discussing how our muscles and bones respond to physical activity. Well, the whole idea of adaptation and how exercise brings about that adaptation. We now know there's no two ways about it. Without exercise, you're not going to sort of adapt and build as far as, you know, the musculoskeletal system is concerned. We have a question here. I am in my 60s. All my life, I've been able to walk long distances, but I cannot run. My legs experience tightness, cramps. Why is this so, and what can I do?
Okay. Two ways of looking at the question. One is you were able to run in the past and now you can't. And the other one is you're never able to run. So I don't know which is which. So let's look at your immediate symptom, which is the fact that your muscles are tight and you have cramps. A little bit difficult to say without examining you, but my approach would basically first to look at, are the hinges above and below, which is the knee, hip and ankle, are they freely mobile? Are there any changes in them which are consistent with deterioration, which say that you should unload the joint? And if that wasn't the case, then I'd go through assessing each of the individual muscle groups and seeing, was there a particular pattern of weakness? If there's a particular pattern of weakness, I'd try and relate that back to, well, is this again related to common aging type conditions, or is it something new?
Well, this person says he's not been able to run all his life, actually.
Okay, so no reason why you should be able to. Why should you have ever been able to run all your life? Maybe you're just built in such a way that running's uncomfortable for you.
Okay. So hence the cramps and the tightness and all of that.
Yeah.
You're just made like that.
Just made like that.
Okay. So weight doesn't play a role. All of that doesn't play a role.
People bang on about weight incessantly.
That's because that's what we've been told.
Yeah, well, you've been told wrong, haven't you?
Okay. That it stresses the musculoskeletal system, and that is true.
To a certain extent, because if you accept that dogma, you don't then allow for adaptation. So if you say, well, you're heavy to the point where certain things are being overloaded and biomechanically I can see how that is, then I'll accept it. But the number of aunties and uncles who come in, plonk themselves down on the chair and say, "Ayo, my knees hurt. Everybody tells me I'm too fat." I say, "No, that's not true. There's lots of reasons why your knees hurt."
But it may have contributed to the problem.
Yeah, you know, so may have the weather. The question, the question is,
don't listen to him.
Show me the objective mechanical problem. I'm not asking for a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study. I'm just asking for a very simple biomechanical show me the problem. So for people who have lost the cartilage on the inside of their knee, they say, "Look, I can sit to stand, I can start walking, but after 40 minutes, the inside of my knee really aches." I say, "Yes, you lose 5 kilos, your pain will halve." Those, in those people, for sure. But in somebody else who says, "Look, you know, I can sit down and it's comfortable and I sit down, but when I try to get up, I have to really struggle and push and pull myself up. And then after I warm up, I can walk." Now, that pain's not coming from the cartilage. That pain's coming from extra-articular structures, which are structures outside of the knee joint. That's a completely different assessment. They can lose 5 kilos, not going to make any difference to their symptoms.
Okay. So it could just be wear and tear as well.
Exactly right.
Okay. Let's talk about bone density. How does that affect our mortality or longevity?
Okay. Now, bone density is a statistical concept. It's not necessarily intuitive biologically. We know that.
What does that mean?
Okay. How do we know that bone density is low? How do we know low bone density is bad? Because we look at lots of people and we look at what happens to you if you have low bone density. The answer is you die. If you have low bone density, you die.
Why?
That one don't know yet.
Oh.
So that's why I said it's not a clear biological concept, right? So biological concept means your heart wall is too thick, it becomes very stiff, the blood cannot fill, it pulls at the back, you have heart failure, and that makes you short of breath. That's a biological concept. I can explain by a series of events through science, which is known, how A causes B, and there's a reversibility. If I reverse B, then A goes away. The problem with osteoporosis is that it's a statistical concept, meaning that we know from population studies that if you have low bone density, you will die. More, not you will die for you, everybody dies, but if you have low bone density, your risk of dying in comparison to someone who doesn't have low bone density is maybe double, triple, quadruple, whatever. So that we know. We don't know why people die when they have low bone density.
What do they die of?
Good question. So let's look at the hospital statistics. So let's say that little old lady falls down and breaks her hip. She dies in hospital usually of an infection, either in the lung or the urinary tract, or a clot in the leg. Those are the three common things. If she goes for surgery and she survives the surgery, then in the ward it's usually from a heart attack, stroke, clot in the leg, or infection again. So the one-year mortality, meaning that if 100 little old ladies have very brittle bones and they break the hip and they go to hospital, 25 out of those 100 won't survive the hospital admission. That means they will not leave hospital walking. Out of the remainder, another 25 will die in the first year. So that's a 50% one-year mortality, which is higher than almost every cancer that's imaginable.
Mm.
So that's a statistic. That's the challenge. It's a statistical diagnosis. So if you say, well, what happens if I give treatment to prevent people from having low bone density? Does it make them live longer? Answer is yes. If you reduce the osteoporosis, you make them live longer.
And you do that by supplement? Supplementing?
You give them medication. So firstly, we increase their level of physical activity to reduce the rate of bone decline. We make sure that they have an adequate intake of calcium and vitamin D. And then we give them tablets. So that's sort of the order in which we do things. And we monitor them every 2 years. The problem with the monitoring is nobody remembers. So you have to have a test once every 2 years. The only person who's going to remember is you. So I have women who come in and say, "Yeah, you know, I had one test. It was okay." So when was your test? About 6 years ago. Know, what happened to them every 2 years?
My concern is everyone's running bone density tests out there.
Let's clarify the everyone. The ultrasound-based bone density tests cannot be used for diagnosis, right? Let's make that very clear. They're theoretically a screening tool. Even that philosophically I disagree with. because you can run the same test on the same person at different times of the day and get a different result. So the World Health Organization has basically given its stamp to this thing called a DEXA scan. It's a special type of X-ray that's known to be reliable. So the answer is not everybody's running a proper DEXA scan. If you have a proper DEXA scan, you should then get it addressed.
Okay. And my worry is even young people are doing this test.
No, they're doing the ultrasound ones. You know, you go out for lunch, the pharmacy's running promo. You know, you put your heel in the bath and say, oh no, you have osteoporosis, you better buy this calcium supplementation. Blind Freddy can see what's going on there.
So how?
Don't do la. Just because free doesn't mean you have to take.
But what if you are? But what if it is?
Well, it's an issue of risk. What is the risk of you being otherwise fit and well, of having osteoporosis with no previous medical conditions, no comorbid issues, non-smoker, with...
But it's going to reduce my lifespan.
But later. So that's why I said it's a statistical definition. Okay. They didn't look at 20-year-olds. They looked at old people.
Okay. So, all right. So the jury's still out there.
Yes. No, okay. The jury's not out. The jury's in for that particular cohort.
Okay. Nick, you have a question.
Hi, Dr. Rajesh. I have a question. I was intrigued by what you said about how the ligaments and tendons have a set number of cells and they generate,
grow.
Lay more fibers and whatnot.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, with regards to the current en vogue orthopedic treatment, stem cell injections, what's your stance on that? Because that's supposed to help with cell regeneration, cartilage regeneration, for instance. What do you think about this avenue of treatment?
Okay. Thank you very much, Nick.
Thank you.
Thanks for that. Bye bye.
Okay, Nick. So,
be careful what you say.
Yes, I know. Let's start by stem cell is a controversial area.
Absolutely.
Okay. So the thing about, let's go to this idea of plasticity that I introduced originally, right? So all skeletal tissue can become another skeletal tissue, which makes it a prime candidate for regenerative treatments. In fact, there's some research coming out of the US to say that this field of orthobiologics, which is the biologic use of orthopedic things, as it were, you know, stem cells can be a substitute word for that. The entire market in 10 years is going to be double the size of the whole of the orthopedic market today, just for orthobiologics. So the idea of replacing orthopedic tissue is very, very attractive because it's very straightforward. You know, of all the potential tissue engineering applications that you have, orthopedics is almost, it's literally is the simplest field. It's also the field where the need is very, very great because there are people losing so much orthopedic tissue in motor vehicle accidents and degenerative conditions and things like that. So I think stem cells have an immense potential. I think, though, that the question put forward must be very, very crisp, which is, for example, I have a segment of bone defect of 5 centimeters. Can I solve this problem using an orthobiological solution? First question. Second question, is there an alternative which is already better or more established? So you really have to frame your question very clearly. So if your question is, can stem cells replace lost cartilage? The answer is, your question is not crisp enough. If you have a car accident and you smash your knee, and I put the joint back together, and when I put the joint back together, I find lots of missing pieces of cartilage, like tiles missing off a floor. And I come back, you know, so I patch you up together, stitch you back, you know, send you for physiotherapy, you do all the normal stuff. Then if you come back 6 months later and I put a camera in your knee, those defects have already been filled. Okay, so that's traumatic cartilage loss. So in traumatic cartilage loss, the body will actually fill the defect and it'll fill it with a B-grade cartilage, not the God-given A-grade cartilage you have. But by looking at it, you wouldn't be able to tell. So that we know from experience. The challenge is, in a situation where someone says, I have knee pain, they do an MRI, the MRI shows an area of cartilage loss. Now, if you go and replace that cartilage, will it grow cartilage? Yes. Why? Because we know the mechanics, the biology of it works. Will it resolve your problem permanently? I don't know. And that's a question, because the question I would ask is, why did that cartilage ulcer form in the first place? So there's something in the biomechanics there that needs to be looked at and potentially corrected before the decision to replace the cartilage is made.
Because it will happen again.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So the cartilage repair and replacement for degenerative conditions, it's a little bit of a red herring at the minute. Because if you go to Mid Valley today and you get 100 aunties and uncles age 60, and you MRI or ultrasound or CT scan or X-ray, all of them, probably, let's say conservatively, half of them would have lost their cartilage, but nobody's complained of any pain. So you cannot automatically make the assumption that cartilage loss equals pain and growing cartilage back equals the panacea.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that this is a reasonably strong stand on it, but the epidemiology argues very, very strongly for the fact that loss of cartilage doesn't equal pain. There's just, you cannot explain that finding away, because it's a fact, it's an epidemiological fact. So how do you then explain joint pain with cartilage loss? You have to say, what structure is causing the pain? Is it the cartilage, or is it another structure which is not the cartilage? And I think that's where stem cell has gone wrong. Everybody all around the world is obsessed with growing back cartilage, not asking, should I be growing back cartilage?
Or whether it's something else.
Or whether it's something else.
Mm, okay. But loss of cartilage for some people does equal pain.
Yes, and that's where the orthopedic skill comes in. Is this person's pain coming from loss of cartilage, or is this person's pain coming from something else,
mm-hmm.
irrespective of the loss of cartilage? And we know this when I used to do joint replacements, when I used to assist in doing joint replacements, we'd open, zip people open and chop bits of the knee off, and some of them would go, wow, this cartilage is still pretty good. I wonder why they had so much pain. And somebody else, the cartilage would be as hard as the bone, would be as hard as marble. You know, the saws we'd use would smoke because it was so hot trying to cut the bone. And they would have moderate pain. We were doing their operation because of deformity. So there's obviously a missing link between cartilage and pain. And that's when I started to look at the epidemiological studies. And they're pretty much unequivocal.
Fantastic. Your message on adaptation of the musculoskeletal system.
It's pretty simple. Motion is the solution.
Go exercise.
That's
go
right.
Exercise. Thank you very much for joining us today. Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.